Considering all the remarkable things human intelligence has allowed us to achieve, it's easy to understand why evolution favored our development of big brains capable of problem-solving, deep thought, and innovation. It can be harder to see the advantages of our emotions, given that they live right alongside our capacity for rational cognition. Maybe the problem is that we notice the times when our emotions steer us in the wrong directions, but barely recognize the fact that most of the time, they steer us toward the right ones. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Take the role of emotion in parenthood. Guided by thought alone, few of us would choose the 20-plus years of commitment and sacrifice necessary to raise a child to adulthood, let alone all those early sleepless nights catering to the very loud and completely helpless tiny humans we bring into the world. But we have evolved not only to intellectually understand that our babies need us, but to love them. And in the moment, love often feels like a greater motivation than our knowledge that babies require round-the-clock care to survive. Theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow is here to talk about all this. His newest book is called Emotional: How Feelings Shape Our Thinking. Leonard, welcome back to Think.
Great to be here, Chris.
You come to this topic from such an interesting personal perspective. Your parents were both Holocaust survivors, but those experiences caused them to respond to future events in really different ways. Your father was an optimist, maybe based on his survival. Your mother lived every easy and joyful moment aware that everything could be taken away again.
Yeah, and it was an interesting childhood growing up with such intense experiences on my parents' background. In all my books, I tend to draw on various incidents and stories that just come to me as I'm writing memories of the past, but especially, of course, for this book, because this book is specifically about emotional, and they both had rather extreme profiles of emotion based on their past experience. I mean, certainly understand how my mother lost her father and her sister, whom she loved very much, in the Holocaust, and all her friends. And my father lost his wife and kid and his family, his parents and siblings. And that all, that turnaround, or that came within, from their point of view, a few years. Not that it was not foreseeable at all, but it was very sudden. And that stayed with my mother, especially, where she felt that everything could be taken away tomorrow.
So did your parents sort of rely on one another to temper the extremes of their responses to things?
Yeah, my mother especially. I think my mother relied on my father to pull her out of funks and keep her, keep her feeling good about the future. She was very extreme. When I was in graduate school, I had a roommate, and I called my mother every Thursday night pretty religiously at 8 o'clock. And one night, or my mother called me, and one night my mother called, and I wasn't in because I was out with a girl. And my roommate answered the phone, and at first my mother, oh, okay, well, did he forget, or have him call me when he gets home? And then 10, 15 minutes later, I'm not home yet, my mother calls again, and oh, where is he? And pretty soon she starts calling again and again and saying, what happened? Something happened. I know something happened. I know that he died. I'm going to find out eventually. Why don't you just tell me? And my roommate took the phone off the hook, and when I got home that night, she said, what is going on here? This was crazy. But that was my mom, because in her world, something like that could happen.
Why did so many generations of philosophers and scientists once imagine that emotion could only distract from rational thought and good decision making?
Well, I think that goes back to Plato and the ancient Greeks and the Christian philosophers afterwards, who made a real separation between your emotions and your rationality. And in modern times, the first scientific study of emotion came from Charles Darwin, who tried to figure out how emotions fit into evolution, of course, because that was his main focus. And his theory was very influential for a century to come, and I think it felt very intuitive to people. It was a little bit like the ancient Greeks, who had the idea of atoms, and that was an idea that is correct, but all the details were wrong, and Newton's laws of physics are correct in a certain way. They describe the macroscopic world, but they're not at all the real laws of nature. And I think that applies to Darwin. His main ideas were that there's five, six basic emotions, that they're each have certain triggers and then cause specific responses, that they're very separate from each other, that they're unitary. So there's one kind of fear, not different kinds of fear. And added to that over the years afterwards was that each emotion has a certain spot in the brain that's in charge of that emotion. All of that sounds very intuitive, but everything I just said we now know is wrong. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to talk about this and how we've learned in the last 10, 20 years a lot about emotion, and the amount of research has really exploded and exploded the Darwinian or the traditional view.
So when you say that model was wrong, you're saying emotions are not compartmentalized entirely from rational thought and different kinds of cognitive processes. They are sort of mixed up in the same brain regions that give us the ability to, say, make a decision about investing money or something.
I'm saying that and more. So first of all, that is a very important point, that as opposed to the Darwinian or Platonic view that emotions are separate and that your rationality has to take charge of your emotions, they're counterproductive and they're separate. We now know that they're not counterproductive, that they play a very important role in your reasoning. But even beyond that, it's not even right to say that you have an emotional mind and a rational mind. I mean, you can say that. Just remember that they're not separate minds. It's a good shorthand, but your emotional and your rational can't even be separated. There is no rational thinking without an emotional component. And so understanding how emotion and rationality work together is an important thing.
So there are times when we ignore emotions to make what seems to us like a rational choice, right? Buying stocks when they're low and selling when they're high. There are times when we allow our emotions to override the choices we think are the right ones. That second option, your father credited that with saving his life.
Yeah, and there's a lot in what you just said there. For example, the stock market. I quote a study in the book of stock traders whose job it is to make money trading stocks every day. And some people in England did a big study of over 100 stock traders. And they did a very in-depth analysis of how they think and how they work, and they talked to them to great length. And they found that the ones who were most successful were the ones who relied on their emotion and let their emotions guide them, and the least successful ones were the ones who tried to suppress their emotions. So that illustrates that emotions play a good role. They sometimes get out of hand, just like your vision does. You have optical illusions, you see mirages. But we don't say that because of that, that vision is a bad thing and should be suppressed. And emotion is the same way. What your emotions do is, whenever you have a question at hand or a decision to make or a behavior to decide upon, your mind has to go through certain information processing to get to the end. And that information processing is partially based on logical reasoning. If A implies B and B implies C, your brain knows that A therefore implies C. That's logical reasoning. But there's no processing that goes on without the data getting put in. What data are you relying on? What sensory input are you paying attention to? What memories come up in mind as you process this? What are your goals? What are your expectations? All these things have to be set up in order for the logical processing to start churning away. And all those things I just mentioned are very heavily influenced by your emotion state. Each emotion state creates a different functional state of mind in which there's different aspects of these things that I just mentioned will come up or will be valued. So certain things that you remember, you may be skeptical about in one emotion state, but accepting of in another emotion state. Your goals will change depending on the emotion state. And your sights and the sounds that register in your brain will be affected by your emotion state. When you're in a fear state, you hear everything. When you're not in a fear state, or you're in a neutral state or some other state of emotion, a lot of the sounds in the background just go in one ear and out of the other, and you don't even notice them. And the same thing happens for other aspects of the data around you. So the emotion state that you're in is inextricably tied to the rational processing.
What is the difference between emotion and what's called core affect?
Well, that's very interesting, because core affect is something that has only been studied for the last decade or two, and we don't know that much about it, but it seems to be one of the ingredients that fed into your mental construction of an emotion. But core affect, unlike an emotion, has two main differences. One is that it's not specific. So in emotion, we have disgust, surprise, happiness, sadness, etc. Core affect is only has two dimensions. It has a strength and has a valence. Valence meaning it's either positive or negative, and it could be either strong or weak. So, and the other main difference is you always have every second a core affect, where there are times where you're not feeling a specific emotion. So your core affect is a kind of proto or primitive version of emotion that's constantly running in the background of your body and your mind. And why is that? It's part of the mind-body connection. So people for many years have been talking about the importance of the mind-body connection, but in this research on emotion and on core affect, we've discovered a lot of details and specifics about exactly how that works. And it turns out that your brain is constantly monitoring the state of your body, whether you're hot or cold or hungry or have an injury that's going on or your heart is too fast or too slow. And all this gets fed into your core affect. So it's a kind of a summary of, is everything A-OK or do I have to take some action to solve a problem?
Okay, so how might core affect shape, say, the way we decide when it's worth taking a risk?
Well, core affect has a subtle effect on all your decisions based on whether it's a negative or a positive. So, and it's a useful effect. I'll give you an example from the animal world. There's a study where juncals, a kind of bird, were allowed to fly down a pathway and either go to the left or to the right for food. To one direction, let's say the left, always the same amount of seeds, whatever amount it was, and it was a certain ration. To the right, it was a varying amount that would sometimes be less and sometimes be more, but on average, it was more than the one on the left. Now, a junco we don't think of as a very smart, rational being. It works more instinctively, but it has a core affect. And we could see how this affects the decisions it makes. So normally the junco would just go to the left and get what was satisfactory as a meal rather than taking an unnecessary chance to go to the right, sometimes get too little and sometimes get more than it needs. That makes sense. Now they would keep the junco's hungry and not give them enough food for a while so that now they really needed to have that bigger dose of food. And that the normal dose of food that they would get wouldn't even be enough. So what would they do? They put them in the same situation, and now they start going to the right because food on the left, even though it was a steady amount, wouldn't be enough for them. They're taking to take a chance on getting more food, and they would go to the right. What is affecting them is this is the decision that they're making in these two different situations using the same logical processing and the same data. But the outcome of the decision is different depending on their bodily state. And that works for human beings as well. And, you know, we have to be careful about it because sometimes the decisions that we're making are unrelated to the bodily state because, in modern society, we have a lot of artificial situations. And so I talk about a situation in the book where people who are on a parole board are judging whether to give parole out to applicants. And that decision should be made on whatever terms, their past behavior and what their crime was, how long they've been in, et cetera. And it's a very important decision because they don't want to deprive someone of freedom if they are ready to get out, but they don't want to let someone out who's going to create more crimes. And this study looked at this judge's decisions based on their core affect, based on the time of day, whether it was late and whether they were about to go to lunch or dinner so that they were probably hungry and tired because that's a very tiring job. And they found that the rate of which they approved the parole was much higher when they were fresh and went down steadily until almost being zero before the break time. So it's a situation where the core affect was having a great effect on their decision making.
And just to be clear, these are not judges and parole boards who are saying, I'm in a bad mood, I'm not feeling my best, therefore I'm going to take it out on this person. They're trying to do their best, but without realizing it, their core affect is shaping their decisions.
Right. When they were interviewed by the researchers and this issue was probed, they were vehemently denied that there was any such effect. and they had never seen statistics such as what the researchers had gathered.
So if you're up for parole, bring muffins, I guess.
That's right.
So I love it when language sort of figures something out before science does. For many years, people have talked about having a gut feeling about things. As it turns out, there is something called the enteric nervous system, and it may indeed shape the way we feel about the world. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a part of the mind-body connection, and our gut is very important in that it has a lot of connections to the brain, both through nerves and through the release of different biological chemicals, hormones into the bloodstream. And so that's really amazing. I'll give you a study from the animal world because we couldn't do this on humans, but it's a very vivid study where they took mice and they bred a breed of mice that had a sterile digestive system. And then they took two other kinds of mice that they bred for being either overly anxious or calm. They can do this with mice. I wouldn't mind being bred as a calm human, but I get that advantage. Anyway, then they would take fecal matter. They would from either the anxious mice or the calm mice, and they would put them into the mice that had the sterile nervous system, digestive system, and they would take on the attributes of those fecal donors. So that's a pretty stark and amazing example of the connection between the body and the mind. And of course, we're still studying that. And it's much harder to do such research on humans, but they are doing fecal transplants now on humans too. And it's in the early stages, but we now know that the microbiome or the flora that are in your digestive system play a very important role in health and in your emotional health.
We've talked a lot about how emotions affect us as individuals, but of course, plenty of emotional experiences happen because of the presence of other people or our awareness of what they might think. What role do social emotions play in moral reasoning?
Well, human beings could not survive on their own in the wild. Today, that's true for most, and certainly in the past as we were evolving, we were not the most fit of primates physically. But what we did do was learn how to cooperate in societies, and we would live in bands of 20, 30, 40 individuals. And by helping each other, we could survive. We band together for shelter, for predation, for escape from predation, and so forth. And so it was very important to be able to communicate, and probably even before we had language, and certainly before written language or any media, we as human beings were evolving, we learned to read each other and to care for each other and to care about each other. So we developed these social emotions to kind of be the grease or the oil in the machine of human interaction. So when you look at somebody else, you can see if they're angry or mad, cooperative, and so forth. And you have social feelings about them. If someone else is hurt, you have empathy. You have sympathy for them. If you hurt somebody, you feel guilty. If you do something that's against social norms and people look down on you, for that you feel shame. If you do something great, you feel pride. All these emotions, these social emotions, developed to help us in our human interactions.
We all think of happiness as a wonderful thing to have, but not strictly necessary for our survival, right? It's like the dessert after dinner. You remind us of the story of Ernest Shackleton, who was marooned with his crew for many months after their ship got stuck in the ice around the South Pole. What role did they say joy played in keeping them alive?
Well, that was really surprising because it was hard to even imagine with the hardship that they had of being cold and hungry and having a very bleak outlook that they would have any happiness. But they went around singing together and wrote about having good times. And that's really interesting. And it's a testament to human strength, inner strength. But it really also was a testament to how evolution helps us survive, because what positive emotions such as happiness do for you is they give you more of an open mind to exploration, creativity, and a resolve to do things. And without those qualities, they could not have figured out the way to get out of there and have had the inner strength to do it. And so the happiness that they felt inspired them to go on and gave them the hope and the imagination to be able to think of surviving.
It's interesting to wonder whether they were a sort of self-selecting crew in the beginning, right? Maybe nobody but a particularly optimistic person would consider going on what was a very dangerous mission.
That's true, and it may also have determined which of them survived. There have been a lot of studies about how different emotions and how you handle them affect lifespan and in particular situations, how they help with your survival. For instance, during the Holocaust, or one story of a fellow named Stockdale who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. And these studies of these individuals what the individuals wrote about their experiences are good illustrations that your emotional state of mind was a important determinant in which of the people survived those hardships.
Leonard, is there an adaptive function to sadness?
Yeah, sadness puts you in a state of mind where you want to change things. So sadness is triggered by a situation in which your goals or desires are not being met, or something happened that is not to your liking. And the state of mind you're in after that happening is one of wanting to change things.
You explain here that exercise and loud noises can both trigger adrenaline surges that make us react more aggressively to provocations than we might otherwise. How common is it that we let the feelings of our bodies, whatever they happen to be, tell us what we're feeling emotionally?
Well, that again, it feeds into your core affect. So if a noise happens that's very loud, for example, that's not normally in your environment, it creates an alarm in your body. Cortisol, stress hormone is released, your heartbeat gets faster. And until you realize what was the cause of that and start to diffuse that turns your core affect negative, and it has a negative effect on the kind of emotions that you're susceptible to feeling at that time, depending on the context.
I had not realized until I read your book that there are cultures that don't have separate words for, say, anger as compared with sadness. How might our cultural framing of emotional states shape the way they feel to us?
Well, that's fascinating. Earlier in our talk, we talked about the different basic emotions. And it turns out that that those aren't, that there are many other emotions, and there are many versions of each emotion. So take fear, for example. Fear of a scorpion on your arm is not the same as fear of suffocation. In fact, I say that because there's a study that studies that exact contrast, and they had somebody who had a brain abnormality. And she could not feel fear, did not feel fear when, say, a poisonous scorpion was crawling up her arm. But she did feel fear when she was put in a situation where she felt she was suffocating. So these are two different kinds of fears. In fact, in your brain, you may know there's a structure called the amygdala that people associate with fear, which is wrong, really, because it's associated with many emotions. And it's not even necessary for all fear, because the amygdala is something that is associated or is activated in the situation of a scorpion, but not in the situation of feeling like you're suffocating. So each emotion is really an emotion category that encompasses many different emotions. And also the border between emotions is blurry. It's not distinct. So between, say, fear and anxiety, there's not a sharp border. And between many emotions, there is not a sharp border. So when we talk about emotions, we're really using a shorthand, not real exact, categorization of different feelings as emotions. These we'll call fear, pain will be a burning, and a headache are both pain, even though very different, et cetera, for all the emotions. And that's what we in our culture, we've come to make these certain categorizations. But other cultures having the same emotional feelings have created different terms and made different divisions and categorizations. And so that's kind of interesting. That's a fascinating thing to explore because it shows you, it really illustrates that the emotions that we talk about are really partially at least cultural constructs. We all feel the same things, but we decide to call them we have names for different things and we categorize them differently. It's like if you look at a rainbow, you might say that color is green and that's blue and that's red, but actually it's a continuum. And what we decide to call, to name a color and where we in the spectrum we put the exact red identifier is really an arbitrary choice that each culture makes their own decisions on. So it's fascinating to study about these other, it's hard to find these days, but isolated cultures, people who haven't had a lot of interaction and say don't share a Western culture or a Chinese or an Asian culture, and they have their own, and we find societies that have no word for, say, sadness or that have different emotions that we'd never think of, like the exhilaration you feel upon going on a headhunting expedition. And you know, it's interesting, but that just shows you that these emotions are not really hardwired and as categorized that distinctly in our brain. But it's a way we've invented in order to speak of them.
I'm always interested in studies that look at the role of gossip, which, you know, we are taught is just nasty and wrong. And I don't mean spreading false rumors, but sort of venting to a colleague about a boss or a friend about another friend. Sometimes those function to kind of make us feel better and just carry on.
Right. So without making a moral judgment, the expression part of gossip is a good thing. The spreading stories, I won't make a judgment on that, whether that's good, but expressing your emotions and sharing them with appropriate people, with your friends or family who are understanding, is helpful.
What does it mean to possess emotional intelligence?
Well, emotional intelligence is something that was discovered decades ago to be alongside of what was usually called intelligence, the logical analytical reasoning, and in success of people to be more important than the former. And what it is the ability to be mindful first of your own emotions and your own feelings, and also to be mindful of the feelings of other people, to be able to read them and to understand how your actions would affect them. And again, this comes from our need to operate in a society. And if you understand what other people are feeling and the results of your actions on other people and what you're feeling yourself, that helps you to behave appropriately and to be a leader and to have other people follow you in social situations.
I'm so curious about your career as a scientist because you are a theoretical physicist by training. You have written books on a wide variety of subjects. How do you cast about and sort of find your way to the next thing that you want to explore in your work?
Well, I've always been passionate about both writing and science since I was 10 years old. And I still, even though I currently am not on the faculty, I used to be in the faculty of Caltech. And now when I'm not on the faculty, I still publish physics papers regularly and do theoretical physics research. But for me, the writing is an important part of life too. And I've developed two different paths. One is the writing about physics, astrophysics, mathematical issues, and the other is about the mind and the brain and neuroscience. And I got first inspired to that by a friend who studied consciousness, and I joined his lab for several years and learned an enormous amount. It was like getting a PhD in neuroscience, and this is my third book on that subject, because I think that in addition to the physics where I'm figuring out how the universe ticks, I also want to know how I tick and how other people tick, and that's what the purpose of these books is, to explore that.
Leonard Mlodinow is a theoretical physicist and author. His newest book is called Emotional: How Feelings Shape Our Thinking. Leonard, thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a fun talk.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you will subscribe to the Think podcast, available any place you get your podcast. You just have to search for KERA Think, and it's free to sign up. You can also listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.